This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present Depth of Winter by Craig Johnson. Narrated by George Waddell. From Albert Camus. In the depth of winter, I finally learned that there was in me an invincible summer. From Porfirio Diaz. Poor Mexico, so far from God and so near the United States. Chapter 1. I turned my water glass in the slick circle of condensation on the smooth red lacquer of the table between us and studied the man across from me. I was afraid that if I didn't pay attention, it might disappear. The seer was like that. It was as if he simply drifted away, giving him access to places without appearing to be there, making other people's secrets his own.
You should take in some of the culture while you are here south of the border. Go to the bullfights.
Adjusting his straw pork pie hat to a jauntier angle, the hunchback smiled.
You might enjoy it.
I said nothing. He looked in my general direction, the smile slowly fading.
My friend Miguel Guerra says you are highly motivated, but that if I can talk you out of this, I should.
I still said nothing. He stared at me.
Do you speak Spanish?
I wiped the sweat from under my eyes with a thumb and forefinger. I had a hard time convincing myself it was coming up on November.
Very little.
He had taken his cheap sunglasses off and placed them next to his drink. His eyes were opaque, and they wandered past me toward the knobby hills to the south that rose from the desert like a bony hand, the fingers spreading to make peaks and battlements as if the mountains were at war with the flat land.
That's not good, because where you are going, there will be places where no one speaks English.
The seer sipped his soft drink and then battered the white cane between the knees of his threadbare pants at the exact place where his legs ended.
Your English is very good. He shrugged. I have lived my whole life here in Juarez and back before the new drugs. We were just a suburb of El Paso.
He glanced down at his truncated legs.
Not the old drugs that did this. My mother traveled to Germany in the 60s and was given the drug that took my legs and my sight and, in the process, gave me this humped back.
He vaguely waved at it, sitting there like one of the battlements behind him.
Did you know that hunchbacks are seen as lucky in my country? That we bring good fortune?
I hope that's the case.
Personally, it has never brought me any providence.
He paused for a moment and then turned toward the Club Kentucky, seeing it the way it was in his mind's eye.
Juarez used to be Las Vegas before there was a Las Vegas. 24-hour bars, casinos, cabarets, brothels.
The seer sipped his soda.
It is said that this club invented the margarita.
He nodded.
Marilyn Monroe sat on that very stool where you sit now.
How do you know Marilyn Monroe? He smiled broadly for the first time, and I was surprised at the blinding perfection of his teeth.
My mother was here.
In this bar?
Si. January 21st, 1961. Monroe filed for divorce from Arthur Miller here in Juarez. She was with two men, her lawyers, Aureliano Gonzalez Vargas and Arturo Sosa Aguilar. They filed a suit of incompatibility of character.
He leaned in confidentially.
A marvelous playwright. But she told my mother he was hung like a cocktail sausage.
Huh.
She also saw your John Wayne drink himself senseless and walk out onto the sidewalk where he fell face first like a tree.
Sensing my disinterest, the seer leaned back against the wall.
Most tourists love stories about Hollywood celebrities.
I'm not here as a tourist. He waved his cane toward me and changed the subject.
Can you ride a burro?
I can ride a horse.
That does not mean you can ride a burro. There are places where you cannot go by horse or car.
Fine, I'll walk.
That is not enough.
He studied the problem for a while and then shook his head.
Where you are going, you will need a reason to be there, or they will kill you just to hear the sound of their weapons.
I guess trying to blend in isn't much of a possibility.
He smiled and slowly began shaking his head. "Let's see, shall we?" His face became somber, and his mouth hung open as if he were tasting the air between us like a snake. "From the timbre of your voice and lung capacity, I would say you are at least 200 pounds, and from the way the floorboard creaked when you walked in, I would say 250. "I am. From the angle of your voice, I would say you are 6'4" or 5". "5". "Facial structure also affects the voice. You are of Northern European descent, so I am guessing blondish, but considering your age, possibly grey, and with blue eyes, but not pure blue. More likely blue with either green or grey."
"Grey, no blue. Ah, eyes are difficult. But you will have to forgive me in that I have never actually seen blue or grey or any other colours for that matter."
He glanced toward the bar where he knew without seeing that the entire staff of 4 aged bartenders were watching and listening to us. "And from the deference of the staff, I am guessing your persona is formidable." I sighed. "Lately..."
"You are armed?"
"Yep."
"With what?"
"Colt 1911. He shook his head at the antiquity of my sidearm.
"Why the 45?
"Because they don't make a 46. He smirked and allowed his sightless eyes to rest on the surface of the small table between us.
"I regret having to ask, but can you shoot?"
"Yep."
"How well?" "Well enough for whatever needs to be done."
He paused for a moment and then nodded.
"Maybe we use this."
He tipped his head to one side. "There have always been men who come here from your country, mostly for money and women. But other things, too. I propose a safari, but not for animals."
"For what, then?"
"There were men like yourself who came to Old Mexico in search of antiquities. Even now, there was a good friend of my cousin's, a Mr. Guzman, who was here searching for a particular Russian Model P made by your Colt company. Jose Guzman." I smiled, although I think his friends call him Buck. "I believe that is his name, see. He was a lawman like you. You know him?
A legend.
My cousin was with him when he bought the single-action pistol from a fat policeman who was directing traffic in the middle of the street in Nogales." He sipped his guayaba jarritos. "What kind of lawman are you?"
"I'm Soroka County Sheriff, Wyoming. We don't see many sheriffs."
He warmed to his purveyor of antique armaments idea, and nodded more vigorously. "This will provide us with an excuse for being in areas where we might not normally be, and it gives us a bargaining reputation without the hazards of drug money." He finished his soda.
"I will begin spreading the word that there is a gringo in town looking for vintage armaments and that he will be traveling around the area south of here."
"We?" He lowered his eyes. "Yours is a good cause, and I would like to help you." I shook my head, but then spoke, realizing he couldn't see my response.
"I can't let you do that. I appreciate your help, but if you go with me, you're likely to be killed."
"I am half dead now, so what does it matter?" He folded up his cane and reached out his arms like my granddaughter Lola did when she wanted to get out of her high chair.
"We will need a driver."
I finished my water and pushed the old wheelchair, which was painted a vibrant turquoise and orange, toward the door, the cane across his knees.
"You're not going, and I don't need a car. I have a truck parked on the other side."
His turn to shake his head at me.
"A new truck?"
"I don't know, a rental. It's blue, I think." He took charge and wheeled past me down the bar toward the front entrance.
"Too new for our purposes, and the U.S. plates are too conspicuous. We will need something that blends in along with the driver who knows the roads."
Hastily, I tossed a few pesos onto the table before following after him.
"I thought cars couldn't go on the roads where we're going."
He called back over his shoulder.
"Eventually, but first we will need a driver and a vehicle that will not arouse suspicion."
One of the old bartenders opened the glass door for him and then assisted me in getting him over the rubber threshold with a demeanor that read, "Happy to be rid of the both of you." Blinking from the bright sun and pulling at my sweat-soaked shirt collar, I joined the seer on the streets. "Does it ever cool off in this damn place? It snowed here 37 years ago." He replaced his inside sunglasses for the oversized ones that he used outside. "In the winter at night it gets colder," he grinned. "Sometimes." We had reached the curb when a large, honest-to-God, pink 1959 Cadillac convertible pulled into view and slid up in front of us like a pulsating puddle of Pepto-Bismol, oozing to a stop. A young man with long hair and amazingly thick glasses got out and came around, opened the door and saluted me. "Hola, Capitan!" The seer gestured toward the young man. "My nephew, Alonso, our driver." I gave him my hand. "Walt Longmire." "Good to meet you." He lifted his uncle from the wheelchair, carefully placed him in the passenger seat, and then put the conveyance into the cavernous rear. I leaned forward, but the seer stopped me with his cane. "We have not discussed the fee for our services." I figured we'd get to that. He gestured toward his nephew and stuck a hand out. $100 apiece per day, plus expenses. "Driving this gas alone should be another 1,000. I shook his hand and noticed how strong his grip was, then reached out and tapped the Longhorn steer horns mounted on the hood. "So is this the inconspicuous vehicle we'll be taking south?" Alonso gunned the motor. "This sunless, goat-fornicating, godforsaken, flat-beer-tasting beast will carry us as far as the equator if need be." He grinned, and you could tell that he and the seer were from the same genetic corral. "We will see you tonight at Our Lady of Guadalupe Cathedral." He threw an arm over the side of the caddy and pointed down the street. "I will meet you inside a little before 9 p.m. He turned his head. "Any questions?" "Yep." Running my eyes over the glossy flanks of the hot pink caddy and the outrageous tail fins, the largest ever produced, I stuffed my hands in my jeans and glanced at him. "How much Mary Kay did you have to sell to get this thing?" On the long trip back to the Avenue Benito Juarez Bridge, I thought about what I was doing. I was a stranger in a strange land, and my backup was a legless, blind humpback and his Coke bottle-lensed, caddy-driving nephew, neither man instilling a great deal of confidence. The sidewalk became more crowded as I approached the Border Patrol building on the right, and I was reminded of the cattle chutes we used in Wyoming as I took the general entrance back into my country instead of the one to the left for Americans with documents. I had to remember to get a passport. Standing in the long line, I looked around me and figured that the seer had been right about my blending in. I was going to have to lose about 8 inches, 40 pounds, and investigate a pigment transplant. Behind the plexiglass, a bored-looking young woman gestured for me to step forward. "American citizen?" "Yep." "ID?" I pulled out my driver's license and handed it through the opening at the bottom. She studied it for a moment, and I watched as her left hand slipped beneath the counter. A moment later, another uniformed individual was standing beside her and motioned for me to go to the unmarked door to the right, not the general one to the left. "Is there a problem?" "Not really, except that you're supposed to have a passport to enter Mexico, even if you don't really need one to get back in the U.S. The older man, who was stationed behind the young woman, motioned again, and she turned back to me with a practiced smile. "Just a routine check. You're the lucky 1,000,000th customer of the day." I nodded and followed my license. The heavy door buzzed, and I pushed it open and entered a short hallway. The Border Patrol guy appeared from the other side and pointed toward the door at the end of the hall. "Do I get a prize or anything?" "Oh, yeah, it's in there." I walked down the hall, and just as my hand touched it, the door buzzed and the lock sprang. FBI Special Agent in Charge Mike McGroder sat reading from a file folder at a metal table with his loafered feet on its surface. "I told you not to go by yourself." "Your socks don't match." I sat in the chair opposite him. "I was just doing a little sightseeing." "Did you know that Marilyn Monroe got her divorce from Arthur Miller in Juarez?"
"No."
"Did you know he was hung like a cocktail sausage?"
"Walt."
He glanced at the camera in the corner of the ceiling behind him. "You were reconnoitering in a foreign country, and you're lucky I've got pull and can get you back in this one. As far as I can remember, I'm an American citizen. An armed American citizen in Mexico, which means you get the nicest corner cell in the shittiest maximum security prison in the free and sovereign state of Chihuahua." I just wanted to get the ball rolling. Okay, Sisyphus. He put his feet on the floor, tossed the file onto the table, and ran a palm over his crew cut. I've got you a meeting with the AIC and the DEA guy here in El Paso tomorrow at 4:30. I'll already be gone. Walt? He placed his elbows on the table, lacing his fingers as a chin rest. They know you're coming. Hell, they're planning on you coming, and they're going to have a very warm reception for you. I figure. I'm just trying to give you a fighting chance at survival. Doesn't matter. Look, let's set ourselves up for success here. I think getting your daughter out of Mexico and you surviving it is what we're shooting for. Me surviving would be nice, but I doubt it'll happen. I sat back in my chair with the image of a 5-year-old girl with reddish hair dancing through a pasture as the horses looked on. He knows I'm here. He knows I know he's got her. And he'll kill her if I don't play by the rules. I reached under my lightweight jacket and pulled the aforementioned .45 from the small of my back and placed it on the table between us. That's what I've got. Now I know I'm going into a fight, so I'll gladly trade it for a rifle, a shotgun, an RPG, a Sherman tank, or an atomic bomb, but that's what I've got. Not anymore, he reached across the table and slid my Colt back toward him without looking at it. You wait until tomorrow afternoon for the meeting with the authorities, and then we'll formulate a plan to save your daughter. I coughed a laugh. You think those guys know what's going on down there? More than some jumped-up sheriff out of Wyoming, yes. He waited a moment and then added, You arrived last night. What the hell is the hurry? I stood, and for a lack of anything else to do, took a few short steps. My daughter, Mike. It's like I'm walking around with a hole in the middle of me, and all I can do is listen to the wind blow through. I'm going to do something, and I pray it's not the wrong thing, but I'm going to do something. I made the next statement to the camera lens in the corner. I'm not waiting. He'll know we're planning something, and then we'll fold up the tents along with Katie, and they'll disappear, and I can't have that. Mike came around the desk and sat in the corner. You don't know what you're doing. And you could set off a cartel war that might wind up killing thousands of innocent people. His turn to glance at the camera. I need your badge. You didn't give me this badge. The people of Absaroka County did. Let's not make this any harder than it is, okay? Turning my eyes back to him, I pulled the badge wallet from my shirt pocket, holding it for a moment, and tossed it on the table. You're arresting me? We're not letting you back into Mexico. Try and stop me. I walked toward the door where I'd come in, but the latch held fast. I turned to look at him. He picked up my sidearm and wallet, placing them together in one hand and stuffing them under his arm. I just did. It was a waiting room, but both doors were securely locked, so it might as well have been a cell. There were 3 chairs and the desk where Magruder had had his conversation with me. I'd seen a lot of those desks in federal buildings. Somebody must have had a sale. I sat behind it and looked for the button Magruder must have used to unlock the doors, but couldn't find it. Opening one of the drawers, I discovered 2 paperclips, a busted swing line stapler and a thumb-worn biography of Ambrose Bierce, so old that he might have owned it himself before disappearing into Mexico all those years ago. By chapter 5, I decided that the book was actually pretty good, and only lowered it when an elderly gentleman in coveralls opened the door through which Mike had disappeared. The custodian was holding a mop and kicking a commercial bucket in front of him as I stood. He saw me and started to close the door, but I recognized an opportunity when I saw one. Hold on, I'll get out of your way. He paused for a moment, and I gestured with the book. I can find somewhere else to read. Are you sure? I clutched the door in one hand and looked out past his shoulder to the empty hallway behind him. Oh, yeah, it's about time for me to get out of here anyway. Truer words having never been said, I slipped past and then turned and held the door. This thing sticks, so I'd just leave your bucket in the doorway if I were you. It had sounded as though Magruder had gone straight down the length of the hallway, so I tried the corridor on the right and discovered a bathroom with a window just big enough to pass a house cat through. Abandoning that path, I tried the other side and discovered another holding cell, so my old cell, which was being mopped, a new one, the bathroom, or door number 1. I crossed back to where the old guy was mopping and carefully moved the bucket so that the door quietly eased shut. Clutching my trusty tome, I marched down the hall and swung open the door at the end, only to be confronted by an armed private first class in his battle dress uniform, who pushed off the wall and looked at me questioningly. Hanging on the door, I made sure he saw the book. "Aye!" He pushed off the wall. "Aye?" I threw a thumb over my shoulder. "Hey, none of my business, but I think there's a janitor locked in that waiting room at the end of the hallway." I gestured with the Ambrose beers. I was headed to the bathroom and heard some pounding. "Can't you let him out? I think the door's stuck, and like I said, I'm headed for the bathroom." The private nodded as he brushed past me. "With the amount of holdies we've got daily, they sometimes use these waiting rooms as cells and they don't have passage locks." "Yep, somebody ought to do something about that." As he strode down the hall, I slipped up another passageway and turned a corner where there was a glass wall connected to another, more elaborate conference room. I was close enough to see the back of Mike McGroder's head, along with a couple of other guys in suits, going over what looked like a long list of items being pointed out by a young man whom I didn't know. Since he was the only one turned toward me, I smiled, waved the invaluable beers, and mouthed the words, "It's really good," and kept walking. He paused for a moment, somewhat perplexed, and then waved and went back to his agenda. There were two large glass doors past what looked to be the public reception area and a counter where two more Border Patrol agents were talking to a long line of people. I knew the drill by now, so I pushed open one door and headed for the outside without pause. I was through and on the sidewalk when I heard someone behind me. I turned the corner of the building and headed for my rental truck that was parked in the $4 a day parking lot. The FBI man hadn't taken my keys, so I popped the doors with the remote and wheeled out onto 6th and then Santa Fe up to East Franklin, where I took a right and parked in the alley beside the venerable Gardner Hotel. I'd checked in late last night, having just discovered the Gardner on this, my first trip to El Paso. With a wink, the nice lady at the desk asked if I wanted room 221. I didn't see why not, and she'd handed me the key. It had been a cold, wet evening in 1934 when the front desk clerk at the Gardner had checked in a large party who had reserved a number of rooms under the name of John D. Ball and Company. They drank a little bit, danced a little bit, but all things considered, had behaved themselves pretty well that night. They had checked out without incident, and it was only when their luggage was saved in an Arizona hotel fire a week later that they were arrested by the Tucson Police Department and identified as John Dillinger and gang. Unlocking room 221, I went in and was greeted by a tall Hispanic individual, sprawled on my bed with pointy-toed boots on his feet and a black Stetson parked on his head, the business end of a .357, which was pointed at me in one hand, and an old linen postcard which he was studying in the other. "Stick him up." It was not Dillinger. I turned my back to him, picked up my duffel, and went about gathering my things, including the badge I'd palmed from my wallet, Henry Standing Bear's stag-handled bowie knife, and my real Colt 45, which I'd left in the dresser of my room. I wondered how long it would take McGroder to realize I'd handed him a paintball gun in a pancake holster and an empty badge wallet. "I'd ask how it went, but since you appear to be checking out, I'd guess not so good." I rested the duffel on the bed and progressed into the bathroom where I gathered up my toiletries. "I need to get out of town, out of the country, actually." "Well, shit." He threw his long legs off the bed and stood, shoving his big revolver into its holster and his sun-bronzed hands into the pockets of his faded Wranglers. "That bad, huh?" I took the postcard that he had left on the blankets, stuffed it in my shirt pocket, and dropped my dop kit into the bag. "Bad enough. They find me and they're going to hold me, already did for an hour and a half." "How'd you get away?" I pulled the book from under my arm and tossed it to him. "They aren't going to let me across the border, either." He studied the cover. "What? You threatened to teach him how to read?" Slipping the strap over my shoulder, I gestured toward the door. "I've got to get going." He glanced up. "I can see that." He tossed the book back and then walked past me and turned the corner toward the stairs. "Come on, we'll take my truck, 'cause I'm sure they're going to be looking for that rental of yours." Stuffing the Ambrose beers into my duffel, I followed and started down the steps after him, but he stopped suddenly and I almost sent him the rest of the way airborne. He turned his head and motioned for me to go back, which I did, as he retraced his steps in slow motion like a Peckinpah movie. In the safer confines of the hallway, he turned. "Two old boys in suits, and I don't think they're selling Amway." Only two? I'm insulted. He pushed me down the hallway and grinned. Well, you ain't exactly Dillinger. He gestured toward the window at the end of the hall. Take the fire escape, but go up, not down, and I'll keep him busy for a while. Then what? There's three bars behind this place, the Toolbox, Briar and Hyde, and the Epic, all with sloping roofs that lead to East Missouri Avenue. Turn right, and there's Chiquita's bar. Go in there and tell Juan Carlos that Buck sent you, and he'll put you in my special booth so you can face the door and have your back to the wall. You just wait there till I catch up. I'll be along directly. Why that bar? 'Cause they don't piss in your beer if you're a cop. As I pulled up the window, I whispered back at him, Guzman, how is it I get the feeling you've done this before? Oh, and don't go the other way, because that's the El Paso County Probation Department offices. He gave me a thumbs up, the end of the appendage missing, the result, I was betting, of a roping accident, and booted open the door to Dillinger's room, while unbuttoning his shirt and singing in a very loud and somewhat off-key voice, I had a friend named Ramblin' Bob. He used to steal, gamble, and rob. He thought he was the smartest guy around. Well, I found out last Monday that Bob got locked up on Sunday. They've got him in the jailhouse way downtown. He's in the jailhouse now. Stooping, I crawled out the hall window, lowered it shut behind me, and swung onto the metal steps. Quietly ascending them, I popped out on top of the gardener just as somebody threw open the window below me. I picked up my duffel,